Good afternoon and welcome. I'm opening the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. A couple of housekeeping items to take care of first. I want to announce we're going to carry over HB 2150 to Thursday, and I will open up a work session on 2875. Richard, if you could give us a quick overview.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2875, we heard it 1 week ago. It provides that expiring charters for public charter schools remain in effect until a new charter is negotiated following the approval of the renewal of the charter itself. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Unless there's any discussion on that, I'll take a motion, Senator.
Chair Hess, I move House Bill 2875 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 2875 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2875 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. I'll be the carrier. I'll close the work session on 2875 and open up a work session on House Bill 2970.
Chair Hess, I move House Bill 2970A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 2970 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I'm sorry, Richard, could you give us a quick summary?
Yes, thank you,
Just
Mr. Chairman.
To remind Chairman. People who are following.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2970A directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop standards related to requirements for associate transfer degrees, notably engineering degrees, and throughout the state.
And the hope is, the intent is to keep them on track for transfers and streamlining. Okay.
Yep.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. The motion passes. House Bill 2970A goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Knope, would you like to carry this bill?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3394. Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3394 defines school for the purposes of the definition of a school zone.
And Representative Springer is here to give us her overview of this legislation.
I'm bringing the experts with me.
Okay.
For the record, Sherry Springer, State Representative, House District 17, and thank you for hearing this bill. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I bring you House Bill 3394, and let me give you just a little bit of background about where this came from, because frankly, you're probably looking at it saying, why are we defining schools? Well, what occurred is probably a year ago now, this came to the attention of Commissioner Carlson with Marion County, and as you know, there are a lot of school buildings not being used by the district that owns them, but there are a lot of these school buildings being used by other entities that are educating kids, Head Start, early intervention, those kinds of things, which is a good thing. We don't, if there's a building that can be used, we want to use it. Well, what has occurred is many of these buildings, as you might guess, are in outlying areas of the county. There's a few in town, but mostly they're in outlying areas. The speed limit going by many of these schools, when it's not a school, is 55. So think about that. You have early intervention, Head Start, bringing kiddos in, and because it is no longer a school that is managed by or operated by a school district, that school speed zone doesn't apply anymore. And so you have small kids and you have cars that could be whizzing by at 55, and I'm sure nobody breaks the speed limit when they're doing that. So this issue comes about because of that, and there was a citation. In fact, I'm going to let Commissioner Carlson talk about that. But it arose out of a citation, and it's, what is a school? Well, a lot of meetings, months of meetings, with a lot of experts, engineers, and attorneys, and all sorts of smart people around the table talking about this. And I admit, one day in the midst of maybe being a little frustrated myself, the conversation was about why shouldn't we take these signs out? So I asked the question, and I'll frame it for you today, and I'd encourage you to consider this as you look at this issue. Why would you want to remove a sign that is creating safety for kids, certainly small kids in most of these circumstances? Why would you want to remove a sign? And I would think the burden would be on the side of proving why the sign shouldn't be there. And you'll hear a little bit about that and how we've come to a resolution with that. The reality is, the law does not define school. So what we have done is define it. Now, all of you being education folks should be asking, what about as far as ODE is concerned and all these other statutes that we define school? This is very narrowly placed, and it is only as it relates to this law. So certainly encourage your support. This had overwhelming support in the House. It's one of those things that makes sense for kids. So I certainly encourage your support of it, and I'm going to allow have Commissioner Carlson chat with you about the particulars. She's done the lion's share of the work on this issue.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative Springer, Chairhouse, members of the committee. I am Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner, and appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 3394. First of all, I want to thank Representative Springer for bringing the bill forward and for all those who signed on to the bill. And as she mentioned, the issue arose in Marion County in the Salem-Keizer School District, but there are other parts of the state that have experienced this as well. And in fact, one of the places is in Linn County, where Representative Springer is in her district. So as she mentioned, as we started investigating this issue, what we learned was that school zone is defined in Oregon statute, and some of us here spent a lot of time defining a school zone, but the word school is not defined in statute. So if something's not defined in statute for purposes of school zones, the county engineers and the folks that put up the signs go to the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, and that's a national manual. So it defines school as a public or private educational institution recognized by the state education authority for one or more grades K through 12. And then it goes on, or as otherwise defined by the state. So currently, Oregon doesn't have a definition. So we're going to this national manual, and it's saying that it's K through 12. The story that happened is that somebody burned by a school zone, and these signs have been out there for many years because a lot of these schools are, you know, they're country schools. They're old. They're kind of close to the road. There's not a lot of shoulders. The driveways come in. They have buses that bring the Head Start kids in. So she went through more than 55 miles an hour, and there was a county sheriff there, and he gave her a citation. And then she went to justice court and did a little bit of research, and the rumor is that she had a relative that was a state policeman, so they did a little bit of research, and what she determined was that the law said that this wasn't a school because it was K through 12. So the justice of the peace set aside the citation and didn't enforce it. So now went back to the sheriff's office, where they're no longer going to be, the courts are no longer enforcing the speed limit in this school zone area because it's not technically a school. So the sheriff's office is confused. They don't know what to do because if it's not being enforced, then should they actually sit and try to enforce it? There's no point. Public Works then is saying, well, we just need to take the signs out. If it's not a school, then it doesn't merit a school zone. So I started getting the emails and phone calls from the Head Start director and the early intervention director and all the folks that are concerned about the safety of the young children. So as Representative Springer said, we held multiple meetings. We tried to determine if there was something we could do administratively. Our legal counsel for the county even suggested we could create a county ordinance that ordained that schools could be include early learning programs, but I don't think that that's necessarily the right solution. I think when it came down to it and legislative council agreed, we actually need to change the law, and the manual allows you to have to define it by state law. And so this is what House Bill 3394 does. And you'll notice that the definition is very carefully crafted because we also were concerned that we could open a Pandora's box and that any daycare center or preschool that happened to be out in a rural area along a road would then be asking for a school zone and a school zone sign if it was any early learning program. So it's just those programs that are in buildings that are currently owned by the school district or previously owned by the school district. So that is our solution to the problem that we experienced.
Well, I thank you for that. I'm wary of this school zone issue because I think you might have been here in the legislature in 2003 when we passed the speed limit for all schools and
the senior moment went.
I could put the times in there, so it's Sunday afternoons, people had to slow down to 15 miles per hour, and it was a huge mistake that we did have to correct, and it had to do with school zones. Questions? Our panel here. All right, thanks. We have some other people signed up to speak. Thank you both. Michael Shields.
Chairman Haas, Vice Chairman Knopp. Well, Michael Shields, Director of Transportation Auxiliary Services for Salem-Keizer Public Schools. Just here to encourage your support of this bill. The nuance of the K-12 language being expanded to include preschool certainly helps with the governor's P20 focus, and we would just ask for your support in this endeavor. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Questions? Thank you. And Eva Pignotti. Apologize for mispronouncing your name.
Pignotti. Very close. Good afternoon. I'm Eva Pignotti. I'm the Operations Manager for Community Action Head Start of Marion and Polk Counties. I'm here to testify in favor of the bill. For our program, this would impact two of our schools. We have a school out on North River Road that's almost in Brooks, and we are currently purchasing Middle Grove Elementary School from the district. So it would be those two facilities. Between them, they would serve 320 children. And our kids are 3 and 4 years old, so they have difficult time with transitions. We do bus children. Parents also bring their children. And it's those transitions from the car to the front door and the front door to the car that are the most risky for our kids. 10% of our children have a diagnosed disability. We do have some serious behavior issues, and I feel that our children are more likely to dart out in front of a car than a K-12 child would. So we feel it's in the best interest of our kids to have people slow down.
Questions?
Thank
Get
you.
Off easy. Thanks. Anyone else here today to testify on House Bill 3394? If not, I'm going to close public hearing on this bill. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3394. I'm sorry. Let me open up a work session on House Bill 3394.
Chair Hess, I move House Bill 3394 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 3394 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 3394 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Roveland, carry that.
I can see that.
All right, thank you all who came to testify on that bill. Okay. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2913. Richard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2913 clarifies that the committee formed by the Department of Education, Bureau of Labor and Industries is established to set goals, develop grant criteria, and review grant applications, and make recommendations related to awarding grants under the Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program. It is tangentially related to one measure that this committee passed out in March, Senate Bill 498, which was the funding mechanism for that Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program. This has to do with the interaction of the Department of Education and the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
I have Brian Chris and John Chandler. Oh, I'm sorry, Brian. Sorry.
Okay.
Looks like Chris entered here.
For the record, Brian Krieg, representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors, Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association, the State Association of IBEW, and Sheet Metal Workers 16. Here before you today on 2913, as the administrator noted, this is tied to 498, which you have already passed. You had a large contingent of folks who came in and talked about the grant revitalization program that the legislature put into place 2 years ago. This is for shop classes, career technical education type classes. It's been a very successful program. And the bill before you today is a very simple one. It just adjusts some of the language in the administrative part of the statute that's already there that authorized the bill. It clarifies a few of the things that we did during the startup of the program. The initial language was a little bit vague on that, so we sat down and worked together. The Bureau of Labor and Industry selects half of the committee members, and the other half are selected by the Department of Education. Myself and Mr. Chandler both served on that committee and worked on the guidelines. There was a lot of discussion about that, and within this, we do note that some of the things that need to be done, if you're a grant applicant, the program needs to be sustainable. These are not permanent funding sources, and that you need to be working with your industry partners and finding out what their needs are. As I say, it's a pretty simple concept, and it worked very well. It was one of those collaborative processes that every once in a while you walk away at the end of the day going, I think we did really great stuff, and that was what we got out of this. So,
Mr. Chairman, members, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, also as Mr. Krieg mentioned, part of that work group. What this bill in front of you does, we're basically memorializes what we did. We went into the process last time, as Mr. Krieg said, it was a little bit vague in the statute. We sat down at the Department of Education with Bowley, had several extraordinarily good meetings, including I came away with the absolute marvel that anything got done on the education front. As much regulatory hoops they have to jump through sequentially, it is amazing to me that we've got as good a system as we do, frankly. What we came out of that with was we kind of evolved into the process that got memorialized into this bill. We think it's a good way to now put it in statute, say for future reference when we add to this program, which will hopefully happen in ways and means if any of you have a chance to talk to your colleagues in that regard when we fund 498, we'll then be able to grow over time as these programs go forward at a sustainable level locally. We'll know how to administer the program at the state level to make sure that partnership, which is critical to this, not just the ongoing success of the program, but the mentorship, the job training, the actual job experience for the kids in high school and middle school is by tying into the industry and labor people that are part of this task force. So I think it's a real nice way to complete the circle. We recommend it to you. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Questions? Senator Robler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It appears that we're removing some of the language with regard to when we first set this bill up and the kinds of things that we were looking for. Is that because we're trying to expand it and now we're not, it's getting away from the pilot, we're getting to another, and there will be criteria developed when they start making the selection?
Chair Roblin, yes, it's mainly Senator Roblin, it is just kind of a readjustment of the language to reflect how the process really needs to be able to work so that we can get the input from the people who are needing the kids to go through classes and become their employees.
Okay, thank you both. Darrell Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller here this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors and the Northwest Auto Trades Association. My colleagues have already described the bill, and I don't want to belabor it other than to mention the fact that in addition to the construction trades, this bill also can help fund automotive classes, which aren't in a lot of schools anymore that used to be. And if you're not sure why that's important, just lift the trunk or the hood on your car sometime. The cars have become so complex that the auto shop programs are vitally needed to encourage kids really with great aptitudes in computer science and technology to convince them to go into automotive trades. And if they don't have an experience where they can get in and get under the hoods of those cars and look at them at a young age, we lose them to other industries. And especially as we look at smart cars that are coming in with that are battery operated and using other forms of power, excuse me, it's very, very important that we try to fund auto shop programs and get kids back interested in those sort of things. So that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And you were so right about auto shop and the technology in cars. Any questions? Thank you, Darrell. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2913 and open up a work session on House Bill 2913. Senator Coe.
Chair Hess, I move House Bill 2913 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 2913 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2913 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. I'll be the carrier. Close a work session and one that might not be quite as easy. I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3341. Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3341 exempts public universities and community colleges from the requirement to enter into an agreement with a for-profit institution of higher education before implementing potentially duplicative post-secondary programs. It relates to existing statute that requires community colleges to give notice to an existing for-profit or private institution if they intend to implement an overlapping program area. House Bill 3341 expands an exemption of an existing process and includes public universities in that exemption process.
Representative Dembro is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, I'm Michael Dembro. I represent House District 45. That's Northeast Portland out to Park Rose. I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 3341, which is one of those bills intended to make college more affordable to Oregon students and their families. As you know, our community colleges work hard to get high-quality, cutting-edge, relevant career education to students at the most affordable cost so that they can graduate, find good jobs, and have low levels of debt. They work closely with the employment division and local business and industry in their areas to create new programs that meet industry needs. We're seeing majors now that would have been unthinkable 10 years ago. But they're part of our changing technologies, of our changing economy. The colleges pride themselves on helping workers retool, remaining nimble and responsive to local needs, while going through rigorous quality control measures with their faculty to make sure that they're doing it right and coming up with high-quality educational programs. It's a rigorous process, but it's a necessary one. When students enter a community college technical program, their graduation rate is nearly 100%, and the great majority of them find good jobs in their fields without being saddled with impossible debt. But Oregon, alone among all the states, has an odd wrinkle that prevents our public colleges and universities from creating new high-demand programs in areas where a for-profit institution might have gotten there first. Under current law, any for-profit college or university has the ability to block new certificates or degrees from being created at its local community college or university if it's already offering similar programs, even if at a much higher cost. Any for-profit college in the area can claim that the new program will have what's called adverse impact on their business precisely because it can be offered at a lower cost to students at the community college. The reverse, of course, is not true. For-profits are free to come in and open a new branch or campus wherever they want. It's a free market for the for-profits, but not for the community colleges. It's a one-way street. And it has had a chilling effect on the community college's efforts to be responsive to local needs. This can have serious results for low-income students who really need access to low-cost public higher education. Students who don't have the community college option for new programs will be forced to pay, in many cases, 3 to 4 times the amount that they would have paid if they could have gotten their education at a public college. The effect on young Oregonians, veterans, and dislocated workers can be serious. Students attending for-profit colleges account for just a fraction of all college students, but they currently account for 47%, nearly half, of all federal student loan defaults. Tax dollars are paying for nearly all of the cost of for-profit tuition, either in the form of Pell Grants or federal student loans. And tragically, nearly 1 in 4 students at a for-profit college will default on their student loan within 3 years of leaving. These are not good odds for our students, and it's taxpayers who end up picking up the tab. Colleagues, proprietary colleges in every other state are able to exist and to thrive without the protectionism of adverse impact. So can Oregon. Don't get me wrong, many proprietary schools are doing a fine job of preparing students for careers for which they will secure gainful employment and pay back their loans. We have a lot of schools in the state that are offering cosmetology programs, for example, where the tuition is actually lower than it is at the one community college that offers cosmetology. Obviously, adverse impact is not going to affect them. But in many other areas, it is a big problem. Many of them are doing a good job, and they do deserve to play. They have an important role to play in our achieving our 40-40-20 goal. They need to have a seat at the table as we plan strategically for better partnerships among our state's public, nonprofit, and for-profit institutions. You'll see in the bill language that was added at the request of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation, directing the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to report to the legislature on methods to avoid duplication of facilities and to leverage public and private education facilities and faculty resources in our state's post-secondary education system. The bill is a little more complicated because of their request, but you know, our hope was that we could come to some agreement with them over that, and so we included that language in there. House Bill 3341 seeks to level the playing field for the publics and the privates, and it also seeks to promote more partnership and collaboration between them. It creates an expedited approval process in which a for-profit college and a community college or university may meet to discuss potential collaboration, articulation, or partnership. If no accommodation can be reached, under House Bill 3341, the community college may move forward with its new program as long as it's approved by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Senators, it's time for us to end the adverse impact system to help create more affordable pathways for students and focus on better collaboration between the public and private sectors that's not done at the expense of low-income students. I urge an aye vote. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Denbrough, can you give us a little bit of history of how this law was put into place or why?
You know, I'm not sure. It's been in place, I think, for several decades. I assume at the request of proprietary colleges, and it's, you know, it's been in place as long as I can recall, actually, and I know that it's been a problem for the institutions, for the community colleges, as long as I can, recall. And when I first came into the legislature in 2009, we did a very narrow exemption from it, which had to do with those programs that were part of what are called career pathways, where you might have a two-year program that is, you know, where a student can get a standalone certificate after 6 months, say, and then goes to work, continues their education, you know, continues on that career pathway, continues their education, eventually with the goal of getting that full two-year degree. We were running up against some cases in which the that shorter-term certificate was bumping up against adverse impact, and there was a block happening. And so we decided to attack that narrow situation. It has worked out well. It now makes sense to just do away with adverse impact entirely.
Well, I'm probably out over my skis here, but wouldn't an easier way to do this, to do what you said, get rid of adverse impact, be to just to repeal that statute?
Yes, it certainly would. I was trying to be obliging to the career colleges, and that's why it is the way it is. If the career colleges are still opposed to it, I'm happy to make that, you know, to go the simpler route.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. Representative, you mentioned in your testimony about some private programs that have costs that are 3 to 4 times what maybe a public program would be. Do you have some examples for us of those types of programs?
I didn't bring any, but, you know, in general, I think if we were to look at a nursing program, for example, ITT has recently begun a nursing program. I think it's about $30,000 or high 20s for its program. And, the community colleges, much less than that.
Further question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Knob.
Thank you. How many times, or do we know how many times a community college or somebody has wanted to start a program and has had to go through the process of meeting with the private entity that may be already be doing that, and kind of what outcomes there's been? Because I haven't heard of at least a problem in my area with this, and maybe it's because we don't have a lot of private programs, or maybe I'm just not aware of the private program. So can you kind of expand on that and tell us
I believe that there was a problem actually in your area, Senator Knob, having to do with a phlebotomy program. And that actually led to the first iteration back in 2009 of this bill. But there may be people who are, I'm not sure who's here to testify from the colleges, so they can perhaps address that. I know there have been a number of instances. I don't know how many, but what was represented to me was the big problem is the number of times that they would have liked to have gone forward with a program, but were pretty confident that it was going to bump up against adverse impact, and so that was it was kind of a restraint of their going forward, had what I referred to as a chilling effect.
Okay.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you, sir.
Great. And I'll stick around if you have any other questions.
John Wyckoff and Scott Huff.
Chair House, excuse me, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association, representing Oregon's 17 community colleges. And I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor today of House Bill 3341 and thank Representative Dembro for his work on this and for working with us in the past on a similar concept around career pathway certificate programs. With me today is Scott Huff, the recently former Dean of Instruction, or became recently former Dean of Instruction, has recently retired from Portland Community College, and who is quite familiar with this issue, will follow me with some more detail about how the program works. Before I begin my comments, I would just quickly echo what Representative Dembro said, I will have the college follow up with you specifically, Senator Knope, but my understanding is that for Central Oregon Community College, this was an issue for a phlebotomy program several years ago that they hoped to begin and were not able. I think overall, what you see at the colleges, and Representative Dembro was absolutely right about this, is programs won't be developed in the first place because they will run up against adverse impact, so they don't begin a program in the first place, and so they don't make it that far in the process because they just simply don't develop the programs. Overall, this is helpful regulatory relief for the colleges. It allows them to be more nimble and to start some programs they might not otherwise have been able to start. But the reality is, as you all know, and you've probably heard us say before, since the beginning of the recession, you know, the colleges have seen their funding drop about 34% while their enrollment has gone up. Their FTE enrollment's gone up about 40 their per student funding has dropped about 40% as their enrollment has gone up 34% and state funding tanked. These are our higher cost programs. These are usually in career and technical programs, which are the programs that are sort of cost centers for colleges. These are not programs off which the colleges would make money. The colleges aren't seeking to do this because they think it would be a profit center. Most of these programs are probably subsidized by lower division courses like a philosophy course or a writing course where you just put students in a room. These tend to be the programs that require mechanics bays and labs and clinical settings. So what this legislation would do is allow the colleges, where there is an existing workforce demand, to create a program that would offer some lower cost slots than are probably currently available for students. What it wouldn't do is give them the robust funding to start changing the marketplace and putting people out of business. And I think that that really gets to what the focus of this bill is. The focus of this bill is to make the focus the student and to provide some opportunities for students. This bill takes the focus away from protecting one sector over the other, or providing a special protection for one sector to be the only player in a marketplace. We don't have that, and it's very much a one-way street. I sort of think of it as, you know, if a local transit authority had to ask ask cab drivers every time they wanted to start a bus line if that was okay, and if they thought that it would cut into the cab driver's bus bottom line, it probably will on some level. But you think of it in terms of a public good and creating a transit system. I'm probably following this analogy a little too far to creating a transit system that is going to be a bit lower cost and usable by the entire public. In our case, though, again, these are our higher cost programs, and I think it would be it's of quite a stretch to think that we're going to be putting anybody out of business. It just creates some lower cost opportunities for students, especially in areas like healthcare professions, where we're seeing shortages, where you're often seeing areas where workforce needs aren't getting met. And this is why the Oregon Health Policy Board testified in favor of this legislation on the House side and called for a removal of adverse impact, and for in some specific areas that they pointed out. I'd just like to read a quick excerpt from their report. where they identify the problem as the regulations require all publicly funded programs to be subject to review for detrimental duplication or adverse impact by any privately funded institution. Our concern with this provision is that it can have the effect of limiting new public programs in various areas of the state, increasing the cost of training or overwhelming clinical trial settings, and has at times meant that no programs became available in an area. Just want to kind of quickly point out the four areas that they really pointed to as problems that are created by adverse impact. They gave examples. One could be that if a college wants to start a program, and let's continue the example of phlebotomy, a for-profit institution could simply say, we are intending to go into that area and have begun developing a program, so that would be a detrimental impact to us, and so the college would not go forward. And then the proprietary school may also not go forward, leaving a gap. That was one of the examples that they brought as a concern. The other is you may have a situation where two proprietary schools are starting the same program at the same time in an area, and you would have duplication, but we don't have adverse impact for the for-profit side of the equation. Another was that a private for-profit program could offer, say, a nursing program where a nursing program already exists by a community college or a nonprofit private institution or one of the universities, and overwhelm clinical settings that all of the other players that are in the field are already using, so that there is competition for the clinical settings, or the community colleges are shut out. We don't have the ability to pay for the clinical settings as some of the for-profits do. So that was another problem that was identified by the Health Policy Board, where the one-way street nature of it is creating sort of an unlevel playing field. And then the last being simply where you might have an area where a program is already being offered, but the cost is simply too high for students in the area to access the program, or too high for students to pay back the loans that they take to get into that program. And so those were the areas where they looked at saying that adverse impact is becoming a problem for the healthcare workforce pipeline, and agreed that it should be removed. The other thing, and then I will close and let my colleague talk a bit about how this works. Is the way the process currently works is if a college wants to start a program and then not in this career pathway certificate area, but in just a general program, the process, if a for-profit college wants to challenge it, can go on for up to a year, possibly more, making it very difficult for the college to sort of make plans around it to want to move forward in the first place. And one of the things that this legislation does is provide a certainty about the timeline. You do know that after 180 days that there will be an answer. In this case, we've moved it from the Student Assistance Commission, where that decision currently rests, to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, which I think is another appropriate piece of the legislation, because what it does is puts it where the Higher Education Coordinating Commission is supposed to be looking at coordinating the resources we have available and looking at where gaps are, and it puts it there and then puts on a finite timeline so that there is certainty to both sides about when that process will end, which makes, you know, preparing for things like this and planning programs like this creates a level of certainty that just currently does not exist. And with that, I think I'd close and be happy to take questions.
Okay. I'll let Mr. Hopp go first. We'll ask questions. Go ahead.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today. I'm Scott Huff. As just said, I was a recently retired administrator from Portland Community College. And I was, for many years, I was involved with the Oregon Council of Instructional Administrators, which is a group of deans who deal with instruction at all 17 community colleges. And during that time, I was involved in many discussions about detrimental duplication and adverse impact. I'm here in support of House Bill 3341. 4 years ago, I came in support of a similar bill, House Bill 3117, which passed in the 2009 session. That bill came to be as a result of discussions between private career schools, community colleges, Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development regarding detrimental duplication and adverse impact, specifically regarding career pathway certificates of completion. What evolved was, or the bill prescribed a process between the private career schools and a community college, should a private career school have a concern about detrimental duplication or adverse impact of the new program? By way of example, I'm only going to give one. I could give a couple of others if you want. Prior to that bill, Portland Community College proposed a career pathway certificate in our criminal justice program. It was for a corrections technician. That career technical education program, like many of those around the state, go to the heart of preparing people for the workforce, and like many of those programs, are in support of the 40-40-20 goal that the state has. All of the courses in that certificate were wholly contained within an existing degree. No new courses were to be offered. The private career school was concerned about adverse impact. We met, had several conversations with the school, but ultimately both schools testified before the Oregon State Assistance Commission, which decided the case in a process that took nearly a year, possibly more than a year, to resolve. The process, though, that came was used and then refined afterwards became the model for House Bill 3117 4 years ago. House Bill 3341 would expand the process to cover all degrees and certificates at both community colleges and universities, public universities, and would once again support the state's 40-40-20 goal. Private career schools would be notified of proposed programs. They'd have an opportunity to raise concerns about detrimental duplication or adverse impact, as well as suggesting modifications to the proposed program. The HEC could be involved as a mediator during those discussions. Ultimately, the HEC would have the authority to approve or disapprove a program and could approve it if there was unmet need in the state, and that unmet need in the state would have to be documented by the community college or the public universities, and it would be in a process that would take approximately 180 days. The bottom line is that the bill appropriately provides for consideration of claims of detrimental duplication and adverse impact by private career schools while providing a clear pathway forward to consideration of those claims. And it would also have the HEC study methods of avoiding duplication of facilities and faculty resources and expand student opportunities at lower costs, and those lower costs being both for the taxpayer and by the student. And in summary, I'm here to support House Bill 3341 and hope that you will as well.
Mr. Huff, what would you say this law has, what effect has this law had on students during your tenure?
Well, in the example that I just gave you, it delayed by approximately a year access to that that particular program, which was a career pathway certificate in corrections and those were people who were going to go to work largely in jails or prisons, there was no unmet need. I mean, there was unmet need. I said it the wrong way. There were plenty of jobs available, and ultimately that was part of the decision-making process by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to allow us to go ahead with that. So the issue of jobs being there has to be considered, and if the process is slowed down or if community colleges or universities don't bring a program forward, then those students won't have access to those programs and access to jobs that would come with them.
Senator Robel?
I'm good.
Okay. All right, thanks. Jim Markey and Jessica Adamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Markey. I'm here today representing the Association of Oregon Cosmetology Colleges. We have members spread across the state. Presently, there's only one community college, as Representative Dimbro alluded to, that offers a cosmetology school, and that's Mount Hood Community College. The rest of the schools in Oregon are private schools. And I want to say that I'm a strong supporter of community colleges. I'm a believer in community colleges. I have children that attended community colleges as part of their education process. I'm also a believer in the free enterprise system that we enjoy in this great country of ours. And I love competition, but competition has to be based on equal footing from both sides. And this session, this legislature will again provide funding for community colleges, perhaps not at the level that we would all hope for, but I just ask Representative Dembrough what that funding looks like for this session, and because it's not a thing that I regularly follow. He says the governor's budget includes $423 million for community colleges. So that sort of gives them a head start on anybody in the private sector that might be running a school either in cosmetology or in any other area. Representative Dembrough and I have spoken many times about this bill, and I respect his position, and he's a great believer in community colleges as well. This adverse impact process has been around a long time, and as the previous speakers mentioned, it's a process that can take a while. There were lots of concessions made and compromises come to in 2009 when we amended the adverse impact bill, adverse impact statute, and created this career pathways language. This bill, I think, is a little deceiving. And Chair Haas, you asked the question, wouldn't it be easier if you just repealed the statute? I would submit to you that it would almost have the same effect as the bill is written. Because the bill is written allows a community college, specifically, if when they start a new program, they're to notify the private schools in the area that might offer similar programs. And if the private schools request a meeting with the community colleges, the community college must provide for the meeting and meet with them and may bring in a mediator, et cetera. And then following the meeting, the community college can only proceed with their new program under one of two conditions, that they either came to an agreement with the private schools in the area, or in the alternative, if they didn't come to an agreement with the private schools in the immediate area. So basically that says they can proceed regardless of the outcome of that meeting. The meeting becomes meaningless unless all parties are there to actually work together. And I would submit in many cases they're not there to work together. I'm really saddened that the private schools and the community colleges aren't collaborating more and that they don't have a better relationship in the communities where they all work. They ought to be working closer together. I don't know if any community colleges would start a cosmetology school, and my piece of this is very small compared to Jessica's, but this bill would allow any community college to start a cosmetology school pretty much anywhere they wanted and charge whatever they wanted, and if it was half the cost of the private school next door, so be it. And they could do that because they're tax subsidized. Now, Mount Hood Community College doesn't do that, and in fact, last time I checked, Mount Hood Community College is charging more than my private schools in the area. But they're free to charge something different if they choose to. And so I think it's a little different than is being described to you, at least in my view, because it's not really direct competition on an equal footing, but rather one side is heavily subsidized with tax dollars. And I do want to point out, Representative Dembro alluded to, I think he stated, and I don't want to misstate what he said, but I think he said that private schools could just start a program any place they wanted at any time. And that's simply, if that's what he said, that's simply not true. We have to show need with the Department of Education. We have to show profitability in order to qualify our students for financial aid with the federal government. There's a whole series of hoops that have to be gone through here before somebody can start a school in the private sector. And again, you know, these private schools create jobs in the private sector, and those people pay taxes, and the schools pay taxes on their profits, and it's what gives you folks the money that you need to fund other kinds of programs to help people in this state. And I'm a big believer in the private sector and the creation of jobs, and I think these private schools have a role in that. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. And we are here in opposition to this bill, though reluctantly. We do want to thank Representative Dembro for his willingness to include the amendment that we requested in the House. And that bill, that amendment did make this bill better and did what we believe to be an important activity of the HEC, which is to begin the conversation around coordination. Coordination between public and private resources, ways to improve using best practices not only from this state but from others, to find ways to work together, because really that's what we should be about in a time of limited resources, both in the public and private sector, and a dramatic need to expand training to meet the state's 40-40-20 goals. We should be about working together and finding ways to collaborate, and we believe that that's what this amendment does. So it certainly makes the bill better, but as we communicated while this bill was on the House side, we still have reservations, significant reservations about the rest of the bill as it is, but the amendment did make the bill better, so I wanted to put that on the record. From our members' perspective, adverse impact in its current statute isn't a bar to the implementation of public programs. Many public programs have come online during the period of time in which adverse impact has existed in the state, which has been over a significant period of time. I do not have the specific date in which we implemented adverse impact in Oregon. Instead, what the law requires is that the public, when the public is considering expanding its resources, it examine what the unmet need is in that area before it enters into that. And if there is no unmet need, if that area or sector is already being fully serviced by existing programs in both the public and private sector, that it doesn't make sense to then expand a public program into that same sector. Instead, if there are areas of unmet need, then enter into those. And like my colleague, Mr. Marquis, has stated, in the private sector, we can't just willy-nilly enter into new programs. We are subject in this state to regulation both by the Office of Degree Authorization for degree-granting institutions and through the Department of Education Career College Unit for non-degree but rather certificate-granting institutions. Those processes can take a year, 18 months, 2 years to get through those processes from the private sector side. A significant backlog exists there, as I've testified previously in front of this committee in support of additional fees for that agency paid for by the private sector. Oregon has a very high bar when it comes to regulation of its private sector, something that we have embraced and worked on together. We have, in the past, worked on legislation to adjust the adverse impact process where it's been deemed unworkable by the public sector. We were a big part of making the adjustment in 2009, and that process, as described by previous witnesses, was one of collaboration, one where everyone sat around the table, talked about the issues, and together came to a solution. I wish I could say that this bill had come through a very similar process, and unfortunately, though we have again been able to make improvements to this bill, and I again thank Representative Dembro for that ability, this has not been a process by which all of the interested parties have sat around a table trying to talk about how do we improve the adverse impact process, how do we improve collaboration between public and private sectors, but it's been instead a process where it was really just moving forward with this bill. I would say that our sector, like others you've heard today, that we have the benefit of public tax dollars to push forward private programs that cost more. Respectfully, in Oregon, though some of our institutions have access to federal financial aid for their students, others do not. But Oregonian students, unlike those of the community college or a not-for-profit or a public university, Oregon students in for-profit institutions uniquely in this state do not have access to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. It is not a level playing field. Our students do not have access to that support, nor do our institutions have access to public subsidies for our facilities, public subsidies for tuition dollars, or for support of certain programs. And we appreciate that that's the world in which we live, but adverse impact helps to balance that system somewhat by ensuring that when we make investments in programs to meet an unmet need in the marketplace, that if a public sector wants to come into that marketplace, that they need to demonstrate this additional unmet need met by our programs before they go in. If the need is already met by the public sector and other private sector institutions, and a private sector institution decides to go into that marketplace with a program that is not subsidized by the public, that's their risk. And it's unlikely, A, that the program would be able to get approved because that program would be unable to demonstrate how it would be financially viable over the long term for those students. And further, it wouldn't make financial sense for that institution to put the rest of their programs at risk to enter into an area in which they are not on a level playing field today. So adverse impact is really about making sure that as we use our limited dollars in the state for education, something that we support additional funding for education across all sectors, it's very important that we meet 40-40-20. It's going to take all of us working together to do that. But as we do that, that we don't spend public resources in competition with private sector resources where there is not an unmet need. It's about making smart investments that collaborate. We believe that this bill, the component that deals with talking about how do we promote additional collaboration, is very important. The heck, whether this bill passes or not, ought to be about the business of bringing together folks from the private side, from all sectors of the public side, and to sit down together and say, how do we use resources better together? How do we take the adverse impact process and make it better? How do we all collaborate and get on the same page so that we can use the limited resources we have to educate as many Oregonians and get them ready and into a career as quickly as possible? With a quality education, and that's something I think we all can be behind and work on together, and something we'd urge you to consider in this legislation. Thank you.
Jessica, can I play a devil's advocate with you for just a second?
Absolutely.
There are private universities are not subsidized compared to our seven public universities. They don't receive opportunity grant money for their students, as do our public universities. But we don't have a similar mechanism in place for them. And by all accounts, they are thriving.
Mr. Chair, not-for-profit institutions are eligible. Their students are eligible for opportunity grant. So Willamette University students.
I think you're mistaken.
I am happy to check on that, Mr. Chair, but I do believe that Willamette University students or Pacific University students, I was a Pacific University student not that long ago and received opportunity grants.
Sorry, in proportion to their tuition, like the University of Oregon gets.
It is a smaller amount, yes, but all amounts of opportunity grants are limited. That's correct.
And they don't have, they don't have subsidies like the state support for higher education.
That is true, Mr. Chair, though they are a not-for-profit institution and aren't paying taxes to operate in the same way that, that institutions that are part of the Northwest Career College Federation do.
Both of you lobby for large companies that are not, most of which are not based in Oregon. Can you tell me what other states do with respect to similar laws? Do they have this? Is this just elsewhere?
Mr. Chair, I have no idea what other states do. You mean in terms of adverse impact?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't. All of the schools that I represent, first of all, are Oregon domiciled schools. I don't represent a national association or anything. In other areas, we do represent folks that come from other states, but on this, only Oregon schools. But I have no idea what other states do, and frankly, haven't been too concerned what other states do because I think this is a matter of fairness to Oregonians.
Thank you. Thanks. Anyone else here today to testify on House Bill 3341? If not, I'll close the public hearing on 3341. And we have cleared our agenda and no other work before us, so we are adjourned.